Ah, yes.
Okay, Ned, thank you for being with us. Thank you for joining me in the sofa. You know, there were a couple of musicians before sitting here over me.
Yeah?
Next to me, and I don't know if they were more tired than you are, because you did a long trip that started this morning in Switzerland.
Yeah. Maybe they were bigger than me, because the couch is kind of shaky.
Yeah, but this is old. This is probably older than the United States. I don't know. I mean, you know. But
it's hard to do. Yeah, it's been a long day.
It was a long day.
Yeah, it's been a long day, but it's always good to be able to look forward to playing and getting something going, because that's what we're here for, you know. And I love playing, and the guys love playing. And we can kind of get some energy together to play. As soon as the concert's over, then we're ready to eat.
So it's a kind of a regular timing for the next couple of decades that you spend with your instrument.
I think the things have been set up for us before.
So you just went on the track and
just
hit
following
it.
Along.
And hit it.
Yes.
This is another Ned Adderley tour with your quintet.
Yes.
And it's still on the road with jazz. I mentioned this couple of seconds ago, you know, how do you feel with this? On the road with jazz, again and again. Tell me, it's hard to understand for certain people that they were not on the road, and certain people that they were not touring for, you know, lifetime. You know.
I don't know. It's sort of something that you take for granted over a period of time. You know, we play because, yes, we get paid to play. But we play because we love to play. If we did not love to play so much, then we would play a music that can earn a lot more money, that requires a lot less in terms of musicianship, I think. But we play this difficult music because we love doing it, and because it does afford us a life. It does not afford us a life like some rock and roll people, but it affords us a good life. And we get to do what we really like to do, which is create music.
So this balance was made from the very beginning. Well, money and fame on one hand and being creative on the other hand. How this process went through your personal way of going with the instrument?
Well, it seems that somewhere along the way you have to make up your mind that this is what I want to do. I want to be a creative person. People who create don't always, see, people think that because you're creative that you don't do very well. Well, Miles Davis was very creative and very wealthy. And there are a lot of others. So we do what we do and hope that somewhere along the way there'll be a great amount of people who appreciate the creativity that we do. And it happens sometimes.
When did you start realizing that this is a source of energy, when the people are, you know,
well,
after the gig, like,
When you're a child and you're thinking, like I was thinking, that I was never going to be good enough to be a professional musician, but then somebody hires you. In my case, it was Lionel Hampton. When Lionel Hampton hired me, I was only concerned at the time with being able to play his music well enough so that he wouldn't fire me and send me back. So that all my friends would say, I knew he couldn't play, you know. So once you get that in mind and you've got that first job past you and you wander into a club like my brother Cannonball and I did, where Oscar Pettiford was the band leader, and you get to play with these great, great players that we bought records by to hear them play and to play with them, then it only takes a short time before your mind gets made up, hey, this is what I really want to do, and I want to be creative.
Was this the situation, the United States kind of circumstance, was this enough kind of a challenge between the audience and you and record companies and everything without, for example, other continents on the planet?
Without having to go through a whole thing, record companies, agents, managers.
Out of this.
Without dealing with all of that. No. To answer your question very simply, no. Once you get started, most of the time, we never think about finances. You know, when you're up and Mr. Cobb is playing and he's working on you and all of this music is going on behind you, you know, the chords are coming so fast. You don't have time to think about money. You got to think about the next chord. What am I going to do next? What is coming out next? You don't, at that point, you don't think about audiences or writers or applause or anything but creating the music that is going on now, right now. And whatever else happens afterwards or somewhere along the way.
Was there a couple or a lot of musicians that they went through the same thing that you went through in your life that motivates you to be on the top kind of forum? And
I can't speak for other players because I don't know exactly what goes on in everybody's mind. For example, I do believe that there are some jazz players who do think about money. And they think about it a lot because I hear what they play. And I know that some great players have altered what they do in order to, I think, cater to an audience that they think is larger for a lesser kind of music. So I can't speak for everybody, but I believe that the great, great players, the innovators, generally have always been concerned with the creation of the music, you know, and what was going to happen to the music rather than how much money am I going to get.
Let's call the guys. Let's hit the
first. We want to call them individually, or do you want?
Yeah, I mean, tell us.
I'll be very happy to tell us.
Please tell us. You start off with your own way.
One of the things that we're very happy about is a few years ago it was a big deal for a European musician to be playing with an American jazz group. You know, it was something that everybody could talk about, say, hey, did you know he's playing with Oscar Peterson? You know, he's playing with Oscar Peterson. That was important because there were very few. But the world is getting smaller, records out, people get to play more, and there are fine players everywhere now. One of the examples is our current pianist, who's only been with us a little over a week, is Italian, from Italia. We call him the Italian Stallion because he does well. And he's a great player, and he's from Geneva, so I'd like for you all to meet now our new pianist, Mr. Massimo Ferrao. course, one of the finest bassists in all of modern jazz is our bassist. I know. He's bad. And he's just a wonderful player. So we have on bass the great Walter Booker. Talking about legendary musicians, you know, legends in our business. And we've got one playing drums. He played with Earl Bostic, with Dinah Washington, Cannonball Adderley, Miles Davis, Wynton Kelly, John Coltrane, Wes Montgomery, Stan Getz, and Sarah Vaughan, and Dizzy Gillespie, and Ned Adderley. That's not a bad lineup at all. So we'd like also to have you meet the legendary Jimmy Cobb. Somebody out, but you know, that's the way life goes. You know? And we have a brilliant young alto saxophonist. We had a brilliant young alto saxophonist, and we've got another one. It is very strange to me that the alto saxophonist we had, Vincent Herring, won the downbeat poll for New Star, that is talent deserving of wider recognition. And I thought that was very good that he won that. The guy who came in second is our alto saxophone player now. He'll be leaving next year when he wins. But for now, we'd like for you also to meet a brilliant young alto saxophonist. That's Antonio Hart. Antonio. And there they are.
That means that we're having with us Mr. Ned Adderley with the quintet.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you for being with us.
All right.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, Ray. Thank you. That's a song composed by an ex-bassist of ours.
Late, great Sam Jones wrote that one. Song titled Unit 7. Unit 7. Unit 7 was the number of a motel unit in Detroit that Sam was staying in Unit 7 when we were working in Detroit one week. Sam had a marvelous time in Unit 7. So he wrote that song to commemorate having had a wonderful time in Detroit in Unit 7 for the week. If any of you have ever been to Detroit, then you know that it is very difficult to have a wonderful time in Detroit, no matter what unit you happen to be in. But Sam managed to have a good time and wrote that song. I know that Sam had a marvelous time in Unit 7 because I was in Unit 6. But that's the story of my life. Always a day late and a unit short. So I keep on trying. This next song is one that was recorded by my brother, the late, great Cannonball Adderley. He did this a few years ago. It's from an album that is a classic modern jazz album now. It is one titled Something Else. Great album. Had great people on it. Sam Jones, that bassist I was talking about, was on that record. He's pretty good. Yeah, he had a piano player named Jones, too. No relation to Sam. Piano player named Hank Jones. Pretty good. Drums, Art Blakey. Pretty good. Trumpet, Miles Davis. Pretty good. And one of the songs that they recorded, and we're going to do the same arrangement that Cannonball did, though those many years ago. Here is Autumn Leaves. Autumn Leaves. Thank you.
Autumn Lee, Walter Booker on bass, and Autumn Lee, yeah, Autumn Lee.
I'm going to play a song now that was composed by fine tenor saxophonist, the late Hank Mobley wrote this one. We like to play a song sometimes by people like Hank Mobley, who we call unsung heroes, people who never got their just due in their lifetime. Hank Mobley was a great tenor saxophone player and a fine writer. So we're going to play this song that Hank composed, which features Antonio Hart on alto saxophone and Jimmy Cobb on drums. This one titled It's a strange title, This I Dig of You, which is a kind of backwards way of saying something, but whatever it is, when you could write as well as Hank and play as well as Hank, then you could name the song any damn thing you choose to. So here's Hank Mobley's song, featuring Antonio Hart and Jimmy Cobb. This is This I Dig of You.
Run, 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 run.
Antonio Hart, alto sax. Jimmy Cobb on drums. This I Dig of You. Yes, but it makes it a little bit difficult to play because you can't hear yourself play because they cut off the monitor. But we'll keep trying. We're going to play a song that is a favorite of mine. In fact, it is my favorite song. It is a song that I like better than any other song I have ever heard. Because I wrote this next song. And it's the song that made the most money for me of any song I ever wrote. I love this next song. And every time it's time for royalties, I love it even more. So I hope you like it. Here's a song that kept me going when times were hard and keeps me going now. Here's my favorite song, The Work Song. Here's the work song. Work song. That's work song. Thank you. Work song. Once again, ladies and gentlemen, we'd like to thank you very much for our new pianist, Massimo Ferrao. And our great bassist, the great Walter Booker. Legendary drummer, Mr. Jimmy Carr. Young alto saxophonist Antonio Hart. Well, it's time for us to take a break. So we're going to take a break, get ourselves together. We're going to put out our new album so that you can check them out, see whether you want to check it out further. And we'll be back very shortly, so don't go away. We'll be right back.
For the second time.
Okay.
Take a seat. We had a great opening.
Okay.
Of when we did the first part of this TV show. Mm-hmm. And we're doing this second part now. And whenever I'm announcing the second part of this TV show, you know, the people are curious, you know, and I'm curious. What's going to be next? You know, how did you put the second set together? What was your motivation based on what happened, being 12 hours on the road, changing the planes, coming to the hotel, coming to this studio, and so on? You know, what was your idea to put the second set together?
That's because you assume that the second set is put together. It is not.
Mm-hmm.
No, the truth of the matter is, I never put together a set. I never know what the next song is going to be until we're almost through playing the one we're playing.
Mm-hmm.
So right now, I don't know what the set is going to be.
Mm-hmm.
So it keeps the spirit of jazz good. If I don't know and the band doesn't know, then we can't get a preconceived notion of what to play.
Mm-hmm.
Because we have no idea what we're going to play.
Mm-hmm.
So we leave it that way all the time just so that we can stay fresh with what we're doing.
So anyway, there is a kind of a combination and a kind of a motivation for you that you improvise on the size of the hall, the audience, you know, the way they know the tunes, you know, the lights, the sound quality, and all that kinds of things that put the show together.
It's called programming. Mm-hmm. You know, we program the music, but it is just that I don't do it before. I program the music as we go along.
Mm-hmm.
So I really have no idea of what it's going to be, and I deliberately don't even think about it.
Mm-hmm.
Because then I might get an idea that, well, we ought to play this.
Mm-hmm.
The only song I knew we were going to play sometime in the first set,
mm-hmm,
was the work song.
Mm-hmm.
It's because you mentioned it to me, but even had you not mentioned it, I always play the work song because it's my favorite song.
And always in the first set.
Not always in the first set.
You put it somehow.
Not always in the first set. No, it comes whenever it comes. But I do usually play the work song. If we don't play anything else, we're going to play the work song.
When you're playing your instrument and the way that you're announcing, you know, is this the kind of a vibe that it was in common when you were around with your brother Cannonball, because he was superb for announcing the thing.
Right.
It's a certain kind of a vibe that goes as far as the tradition is and your presence in front of microphones and the worldwide stages.
I think
there's something very special.
When you can tell the audience something about the song, sometimes it's just an anecdote about how the song came about. But I think that people understand the music more when they know something about what it is you're doing, you know. Mm-hmm. And I don't always explain. Now, Cannonball used to really explain the songs, you know, so that you knew where exactly what you were supposed to be listening to. I don't usually do that, but I tell something about it. Usually it's something that people didn't know anyway, you know, so it works out.
How do you feel being in the stages all over the world and during the interviews and whatever you do, people are asking you about how it was when you were on stage with Cannonball? This is kind of a, you know, thing that is in presence and is always in touch with you doing, you know. You know what I'm trying to ask, you know, how do you solve this kind of a...
Well, before I answer that part, let me say this. Somebody asked me to do an interview. We were at the Monterey Festival in California. And they asked me something about how you felt about playing with Cannonball. Mm-hmm. And I told them, it's funny. Now I listen and I hear a lot of what Cannonball was doing. But at the time, he's my brother. Grew up together. I didn't really listen as closely as I should have because, you know, I knew it was a
family situation.
But he's just my brother. You know, a big brother is a big brother, don't care what you do. Mm-hmm. So I could appreciate the fact that he was a good player, but I never listened that closely. Until now, I listen to records and I say, Jesus, he was great. I should have listened more. When I've been standing there all that time, and all the time I stand and listen, saying, yeah, that's pretty good. You know? But now I know what a great player he really was. Mm-hmm. And as the second part of your question, mm-hmm. truth of the matter is I forgot it.
About how strong is this in the presence of what you're doing on worldwide stages now in 1994?
Oh. Let's take this audience in this city. People here think of themselves as members of the community. I live in Florida. Florida's a long way from New York and Los Angeles, where all the musicians and the entertainers live. Mm-hmm. I live in a community with just people. Mm-hmm. I'm the only jazz musician in my town. And when I say, well, I'm going to Europe, they say, oh, because that to them is very exotic. If I tell them I came to Slovenia, say, I'm going to Slovenia. Mm-hmm. And they say, wow, I'd love to do it because it's all so wonderful to them.
Different.
They don't know that we had to get up this morning and been sitting in airports all day and on planes all day. And when we got here, we didn't have just enough time to run and take a shower and come here. They don't know all of the other parts, but on the other hand, they don't know what a thrill it is for us to play here. You know, it means a lot to us to be able to play all over the world like this, you know, in an entirely different community. It is a thrill, and we really are very happy to be here.
Okay. Now, let's hit for the second set.
Let's hit it.
We're having, you know, your band is here.
They sure are.
Yeah. Let's do it again a different way. When you're going to start with the saxophone or with the piano or with the bass or with the drums? You know, what is the serving this time?
I have no idea. But I'm going to work at it.
Okay.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you for being with us.
That's right.
Okay.
One.
Thank you. Thank you. That's a song called The Chant. Chant. Composed by an ex-pianist of ours, a man named Victor Feldman wrote that one, The Chant. But Victor was from England, and he called it The Chant. You know, he was British. And we tried to play The Chant, but The Chant didn't swing too good. But every time we played Chant, it went on and got moving, so we don't play the chant anymore. We just play the chant and keep on going. Here, I already explained, I don't know what we're going to do until we're almost through with the previous song. This time, I don't know what we're going to do even though we finished the song. In the United States, there's a government agency called the Equal Opportunity Council. It is an agency of the government that is set up, supposed to assure every citizen that he has the right to a good job and a home and money and that kind of thing. It's a noble aspiration. Doesn't work, but it's a noble aspiration to have. And we, too, believe in equal opportunity. First of all, usually I say what the song is, and I set the tempo, and we play pretty much whatever I want to play, which is the democratic way, because it's my band. But now and then, I believe that each musician should have the opportunity to play whatever he wants to play. And as a result, sometimes we feature members of the band playing whatever they want to play. This case, our newest member is our pianist, Massimo Ferrao. And we're going to have Massimo play whatever he wants to play. This is his time. Equal opportunity. That's what it is. And Massimo is going to play whatever he chooses to now. And because we don't know what Massimo is going to play, we'll have to tell you what it was when it's over. So, ladies and gentlemen, on piano, Massimo Ferrao.
Thank you.
Massimo Farrell at the piano. Massimo.
And I told you that I would tell you what the name of that song was after they played it. And I don't know what the name of that song is. And I asked Jimmy Cobb, since he was playing it, and he didn't know what the name of that song was. And I asked Antonio, but he gave me some other information. He said, the reason you don't know the song is because Massimo wrote that song. That's his original composition. And what is the title?
Samba Marta.
Samba Marta. His daughter is Marta. So once again, Massimo Farrell, piano. Yeah. That. That's great. So I want you to know I was hearing it for the first time too. And thanks, hip song. Good one. Now, because I'm in the mood for this and because of that was so wonderful, I think I'll try Antonio Hart now. We featured Antonio in the first. But we featured him playing a song that I wanted to play. I said what it was, and I set it up, and we featured him. This time, we're going to feature Antonio Hart playing what he wants to play. So, again, equal opportunity. Here it is. Here's Antonio Hart, alto saxophone. He is. Thank you. Antonio Hart, you don't know what love is.
Yes, yes, yes.
Here's a song that was composed by Cannonball Adderley from an album called At the Lighthouse, Hermosa Beach, California. Here's a sack of woe. This is a sack of woe. Thank you.
Sack of Woe. A Sack of Woe, y'all. Cannonball Avenue, composition. Baba da ba di 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 baba. We li di ba di 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 di. Once again, on piano, Massimo Corral. Bi di 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 bow bow. Ba do ba da 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 do di 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 di. And our great, great bassist is Walter Booker. Walter Booker. But do it, did bebop, bop, bebop, bop, bebop, do feel, did it, legendary drummer, Mr. Jimmy Carr. And now, brilliant alto saxophonist Antonio Hart. At this. Well, I guess it's time for us to get away. It's way past time for us to get away. But we've been taking it easy and getting along, and we hope you had a good time because we certainly did. And we hope to see you again in the near future. But for tonight, y'all, see you later. Good night.